Welcome and thank you for standing by for today's conference. All participants will be in listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session. At that time, to ask a question from the phones, please press star 1. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Jackie Glaze. Thank you, and you may begin.
Good afternoon and welcome everyone to today's Allstate call and webinar. I'll now turn to Anne-Marie Costello, our Deputy Center Director, and she will provide highlights for today's discussion. Anne-Marie?
Thanks, Jackie, and hello, everyone, and welcome to today's Allstate call. We have a couple of topics to cover on the call today. First, Melissa Harris from our Disabled and Elderly Health Programs Group will provide an overview of a state health official letter providing guidance to states about the statutory requirement for states to cover COVID-19-related treatment without cost-sharing in Medicaid and CHIP. This letter was released last week. After Melissa's presentation, we'll hear from Julie Bourne from our Data and Systems Group, and a special guest, Ruth Kennedy. You all know her as the former Medicaid Director of Louisiana. And Julie and Ruth will talk about the Medicaid and CHIP telework playbook that we released as a resource for states last week. The playbook provides states with examples of how organizations have adapted to the shift to telework during the COVID-19 public health emergency that allowed them to maintain their work capacity to continue to provide essential services during emergencies, office closures, and other unforeseen events that limit in-person work. After Julie and Ruth's presentation, we'll open the lines for your questions. We'll use a webinar for both presentations and the open Q&A session at the end of today's call. So if you have not logged in yet, please go to the webinar platform. I suggest that you do that now. With that, I'll turn things over to Melissa to start her presentation. Melissa?
Thank you, Anne-Marie. And so I'm going to provide a walkthrough of a couple of slides talking about a letter to state health officials that we released last week. And that letter was on coverage mandates in the American Rescue Plan Act for the treatment both of COVID-19 itself and for conditions that might seriously complicate the treatment of COVID-19. And we'll walk through all of these together. As you can see on this first slide, that we have the statutory citations of the new sections in Title 19 and Title 21 that were added based on the added from the American Rescue Plan for these treatment mandates. These mandates became effective on March 11th, 2021, and like all other of the coverage mandates in the ARP, they end on the last day of the first calendar quarter, beginning 1 year after the last day of the COVID-19 emergency period. And I'll also flag that individuals in the optional COVID-19 group, the group that CMS used to refer to as the COVID-19 testing group, are also covered by these mandates, but it's important to note that they are only covered until the last day of the COVID-19 emergency period. We can go to the next slide, Ashley. So let's talk about the first component of the coverage mandates. So both state Medicaid programs and separate CHIP programs are required to cover, without cost sharing, what you see on the slide. COVID-19 treatments, including specialized equipment and therapies, and that includes preventive therapies, and then also is a condition that might seriously complicate the treatment of COVID-19. There are some distinctions about the scope of these coverage mandates, and we will get to those in later slides. We can go to the next one, Ashley. So the treatment for COVID-19 itself is composed of two sections. One is non-pharmacological items and services, and the other is pharmacological, drug and biological services. The first sub-bullet here is the non-pharmacological items or services. And this has a very broad scope attached to it. And here you see that the coverage mandate in the ARP really means that any service, non-pharmacological item or service that could be covered under 1905A of the Social Security Act is a required component of this mandatory coverage for the treatment of COVID-19. And you'll know this is very similar to the coverage mandate for individuals under the age of 21, the ETSCT, early and periodic screening, diagnostic, and treatment provisions. That also requires the provision of any medically necessary 1905A benefit. And that's for the non-pharmacological component of the coverage mandate for an individual who has COVID-19. The second component is any drug or biological that is approved or licensed by the FDA or authorized by the FDA under an emergency use authorization to either treat or prevent COVID-19, consistent with its applicable authorizations. We can go to the next slide. So you'll see in the letter that services that could be used to treat COVID-19 that might already be reflected in a state plan, those services might have hard limits on them. A state could have a hard cap on the amount, the duration, or the scope of a service. Those limits can remain in the state plan, but they have to be removed in practice when a service is being provided for the treatment of COVID-19. So you can see here the last section of the last sentence of that first bullet, the state should not apply these limits when the item or service is covered under the ARP amendments because it is needed to treat or prevent COVID-19. If the state doesn't already cover non-pharmacological items and services to treat COVID-19, you now as a state need to add that coverage for the treatment of COVID-19 as part of these ARP coverage mandates. That's not to say, though, that states are not allowed to implement utilization management controls. States can still do that, including when an item or service is provided for the treatment of COVID-19, as long as those utilization management techniques are not done in a way that establishes an unnecessary barrier to accessing coverage. Next slide, Ashley. So the second component of the treatment mandate is, or the coverage mandate, is treatment for a condition that might seriously complicate the treatment of COVID-19. You'll see here, though, that the scope of this benefit is not quite as broad as the scope of treatment to treat COVID-19 itself. The mandate here is for items and services that the state already covers under its state plan, and those items and services would represent the treatment mandate for the treatment of a condition that might seriously complicate the treatment of COVID-19. And there's some specific language on the slide and in the letter itself about the period of time that this is a mandate. It's during the period when an individual has or is presumed to have COVID-19. And again, the scope of the mandate is only those items and services that the state already covers under the state plan as of the date of enactment of the ARP, which is March 11, 2021. And you see here, and again in the letter, some examples, but certainly a non-exhaustive list of comorbidities or conditions that could seriously complicate the treatment of COVID-19. Next slide. So, you know, a state will need to make a determination about when an item or service is being provided for the treatment of a condition that could seriously complicate the treatment of COVID-19. And again, cost sharing is prohibited on services provided in that context, as are hard limits on the amount, duration, and scope. But again, utilization management controls are allowed to be included. Next slide. The letter provides some logistical or technical guidance on the submission of state plan amendments for both Medicaid and CHIP. There will be the issuance of some additional information around SPA submissions. CMS is always available for technical assistance. Given the breadth of some of these treatment of the coverage mandates, states will likely need to add something to their state plan, even in the form of an attestation. So more information is coming on the content and the format of submitting an amendment to the state plan, but please contact your state lead if you have any questions immediately or would like to have technical assistance. Next slide, please. Okay, I thought that was it for me. So I'm going to wrap up and turn this back over. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. So now we'll transition to Julie Bond, and she will start her presentation on the Medicaid and CHIP telework playbook. Julie?
Thank you, Jackie. So my name is, Jackie said, I'm Julie Bond. I'm the director of the Data and Systems Group within CMCS. And if you can remember back to around April of 2020, as pretty much the entire country was holding up and moving towards telework, the NAMD, National Association of Medicaid Directors, reached out to us and asked if there was anything that we could offer in the way of suggestions or guidance or advice to states about embracing telework and using it effectively to keep their operations going during the pandemic, which I think we all thought would be much shorter than it has turned out to be. That conversation led to this playbook. And although we freely say, as Anne-Marie mentioned at the beginning, that this is not an area in which we would typically offer advice, we do think the playbook offers a great set of resources in one place of the things to think through as you consider when and how to use telework, especially to enhance your resilience in emergencies. I want to emphasize again, it's neither guidance nor requirements, it's merely meant as a resource. The playbook was developed in conjunction with our partner from the Innovation Acceleration Program, IBM Watson Health, and the primary author on that team was former State Medicaid Director Ruth Kennedy. I'm really pleased that Ruth was able to join us today to walk you through the major content areas of the playbook. Ruth, can I turn this over to you now?
Yes, thank you very much, Julie. When we were working and thinking about the format for the playbook, we recognized that the skill sets on the team for Medicaid and CHIP programs would be very different for the planning and the ongoing operations of telework, both in the event of an emergency like we have been going through, as well as telework for other reasons. You've got the human resource folks, the ongoing operations. Training is a very big part of it. Those would maybe be different folks. IT support and acquisition. So we did plays, and we've got six main areas that we focus on. And the first one is just the planning process. And we talk about, we identify the benefits of telework, and they really fall within three buckets that we identified, benefits for the employees, for the agency, and for the community. So it's important we lay those out, what those are, that you know the goals that you wish to achieve, because that's going to inform a lot of what comes after. Interestingly, early telework very much was looked at from the community standpoint of avoiding cars on the road, that kind of thing. So, I mean, that's just one example of a community benefit. We think it's important to recognize going in with your eyes wide open and know that there are some associated risks with telework, and that by knowing those up front, you can have a plan for mitigation. And we look at the organizational and cultural change aspect, because this very much for agencies, for offices that haven't, where telework is not, hasn't been really hardened, it can be challenging. And we conclude this play by thinking about the inevitable questions that you'll likely be asked to answer downstream about to justify continuing telework or ending telework, and to how to plan early and often for evaluation and assessment. Next slide. So In play two, we focus on the written telework policies and written agreements. We've got just a compendium of suggested policy topics that you may not have thought about for your written policy. Customer service is, of course, an important consideration for Medicaid and CHIP agencies. We talk about not only our Medicaid and CHIP enrollees, applicants, the general public, but also internal customers, which would be other agencies, providers, our vendors, and then even another kind of internal customer is coworkers. We talk about and give examples of how you could set expectations for employee accessibility and communication. And then the part that's very customized and individualized is written telework agreements with individual teleworkers, and we include possible content for those written agreements. Next. We talk very much telework circa 2021 and beyond is supported by different applications and technology that frankly did not exist in 2007, 2008 when we were pioneering telework on a wide scale in Louisiana Medicaid and CHIP. The tools that are there for document sharing, for video conferencing, instant messaging, and chat applications were a long way from the days when email was the primary way of being able to communicate. Of course, we are state and federal agencies are very very much vulnerable and need to think about the security, whether it is with equipment lost or malware or breaching our systems. And then we talk about different examples that are out there for ongoing IT support for teleworkers, much of that first-line support being online types of applications, self-service. Next. Probably no one is impacted by telework more than the supervisor, the first-line supervisor or the manager. The need to, as we say, measure productivity rather than presence. There's no line of sight, physical line of sight like there was when a person was working in the bricks and mortar office. And this is a change for managers, and it's important to recognize that. We talk about choosing the most appropriate communication tool, whether it's synchronous or asynchronous, depending on the type of communication, and about setting expectations for responsiveness so that both the employee who's teleworking, the supervisor who may or may not be teleworking themselves, they know what those expectations are and go in with their eyes wide open. Next. We talk about the importance of the different, we call them telework supports, the value of pilots and trial periods. Think of it as small-scale testing so that you can get the kinks out. It has been very effective for telework. Even though someone is working remotely, there is still the need for collaboration and teamwork. And we talk about ways to build that sense of team. And training is such an important aspect. We've identified many training resources out there. And we talk about the variation in training. Every employee in the agency needs some training because if one employee is teleworking, it in fact really impacts everyone. Then a different training for people who actually are teleworking from a remote location, and then manager training. And then we have suggestions for maintaining worker engagement. And then last, we get back to where we started, and that is telework in an emergency. In this case, it was the pandemic, but we talk about planning for telework in future emergencies. That may be your only use of telework, you could have different policies and procedures that an emergency could trigger. Waivers of certain policies or training. The alternative assigned task could be determined in advance, and we talk about that. Use of personal devices, would that differ in an emergency? One good assumption, which was just reinforced for us with Hurricane Ida, is assume that communications are going to be very much compromised. And so thinking about how you could have things already predetermined on websites, maintaining that continuous state of readiness for telework in emergencies, we have a checklist and suggestions for how you can do that. And so that is just the a quick look at the six plays that we have.
Thank you, Ruth. I'm going to turn it back over to Jackie, I think.
Yes, thank you, Julie and Ruth, for sharing the resources to support telework. It was very helpful today. So now we're ready to take the questions from the participants about today's presentation or any general questions that you may have. So we will begin by taking your questions through the chat function. I do see a couple of questions now. So please submit your questions, and then we will follow by taking your questions over the phone line. So, Ashley, I'll transition to you.
Okay. Thanks, Jackie. So the first question that was submitted is around the expiration of the public health emergency, and it says, with the recent extension of the public health emergency, does CMS foresee continuing with this extension for the complete 90 days until January 16th, 2022, or will states be receiving the 60-day notice anytime soon?
So, Ashley, it's Amory Castello. Maybe I'll jump in. We don't have any specific information about the end date of the public health emergency. And we do know that the Department of Health and Human Services is committing to giving states 60 days advance notice, but we do not know when that would be. So there's no reason to believe that you would not get the advance notice. I mean, I think that is a commitment that went out in a letter to states in January.
Okay, thanks, Anne-Marie. Then it looks like we have a couple of questions that have come in around eligibility and enrollment. And the first one says, why is the SDX interface treated differently from Paris? Why can we not terminate a member for being out of state based off of SDX, even if we take the additional steps that we do for Paris according to the guidance in CMS 9912?
Ashley, this is Amy Lutsky from the Children and Adults Health Programs Group. I think that is a question we are going to have to take back to the team.
Okay, thanks, Amy. The next question says, for cases where, so this is an unwinding related question, and it says, for cases where the state needs to make a disability determination and knows that the individual under review doesn't meet the disability criteria, but the state could not close them due to the continuous coverage requirements under FFCRA, will states need to conduct a full disability review again for these individuals before their cases can be closed?
So hi, it's Anne-Marie Costello again. So unfortunately, we do not have our team that is working on the unwinding policy on today's call. They had an unforeseen conflict. So we'll take that question and bring an answer to the best we can to our next Allstate call.
Okay. Then we have a question that says, can states expect a template for CHIP and Medicaid SPAs for the COVID-19 cost-sharing requirement?
This is Stephanie Bell. I can jump in on that one and say that we are working on a template that will encompass all of the requirements, so the coverage, the cost sharing, I think drugs too. So all those requirements that are encompassed in the guidance that we just put out and that Melissa talked through.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. The next question is related to the HCBS spending plans, and it says, what is the reporting period for the first quarter ARP report that's now due November 1st? April 1st through June 30th or July 1st through September 30th when most proposals were submitted?
Hi, this is Jen Bowden. And we may need some clarification on the state the question, but the spending plans, should update any information that the state included in the initial plans and should include information on, any activities the state plans to implement. So it's not just a sort of tell us what's changed, but it's really just update. It should be a comprehensive plan that updates what was included in the initial plans. And to the extent that the state has not just, for instance, the estimated cost of the activities it plans to implement, the actual cost information, it should include that. And then, as the states actually claim for the increased FMAP, they should, update with sort of actuals on their expenditures as well. And if that didn't answer your question, please just provide clarification.
Jen, this is Ralph, and I'll just jump in and say, because we've seen some recently, if the states are getting approval in their under a program or authority for expenditures back to April 1st, they should be including that in this in their quarterly report.
Okay, thanks, Ralph and Jen. The next question says, is there an update on COVID testing relative to medical necessity for tests not ordered by a provider or where it is for, say, attending a wedding or just for travel?
So this is Melissa, and I'll start, and then I'll invite others from the Division of Benefits and Coverage to weigh in. In the letter that we released a couple of weeks ago now on the testing mandates in the American Rescue Plan, we pointed states and stakeholders to CDC guidance for both the definitions of diagnostic and screening testing and the circumstances in which those diagnostic and screening tests would be recommended. And so states are to be following those CDC recommendations as they could be modified over time as learning about the evolution of COVID-19 progresses. So it's hard to say yes or no to whether a specific scenario would require a Medicaid-provided or Medicaid-funded test, but we reiterate the global specifications about being in alignment with the current CDC recommendations for when both types of testing is recommended. Kirsten Jensen or Michael Tankersley, would you add anything onto that response?
No, you did a great job. Thank you.
Okay, great. The next question says, could CMS give a specific example of a non-pharmaceutical device necessary for the treatment of COVID-19?
Michael, feel free to take this one.
Yeah, thanks, everyone. It's Michael Tankersley. I think one example could be a ventilator, for instance, if an individual needed a ventilator when they were admitted to an inpatient hospital.
Okay, thanks. I will acknowledge that we got a question submitted about returned mail, but as Anne-Marie mentioned, our SMEs had an unforeseen conflict today, so we will take that question back and follow up. The next question says, does CMS anticipate issuing guidance or a SPA template on the CAA mandate regarding coverage of costs associated with clinical trials between now and the end of the year?
This is Melissa, and the answer to that is yes. We have guidance that has been developed and is currently in our clearance process. And at least guidance on the provision itself and the parameters of the new mandatory service that is in effect January 1 to provide coverage of routine services that are routine costs associated with participation in a clinical trial. So I'll ask my DVC colleagues to weigh in from the SPA template side, but issuing guidance on the provision is on our short list, and we hope to have something issued to you as quickly as possible.
And this is Kirsten Jensen, and we are also concurrently working on the SPA preprint and getting that into clearance so that we can get that issued as well.
Okay, great. Then we have another question for our Disabled and Elderly Health Programs group, and it says, prior to the MAT mandatory SPA requirement, counseling and therapy services for individuals receiving MAT for OUD were covered under Rehabilitative Services, 1905A13. At CMS's direction, we are moving counseling and therapy for individuals receiving MAT for OUD to the new item 29, consistent with 1905A29. Does the enhanced FMAP described in ARP section 9817 for these services apply to those services that will now be covered under the mandatory requirement in 1905A29?
So this is Melissa. Oh, Jen, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, so I was just going to say that we are aware of that question, and we are talking internally about it, and I think that we'll have to follow up with the state. But Melissa, if you want to add more, please feel free.
You know, the only thing I was going to say is that, you know, we recognize that over time, and it's sometimes in the not-so-distant past, decisions have been made that a coverage for a particular service or for a particular condition has generated guidance that has directed states to cover a particular activity under a particular benefit category. And sometimes those categories don't neatly line up with the definition of home and community-based services in the American Rescue Plan for purposes of the enhanced 10%. So we're aware of that. You know, it is often a conversation about where does coverage for that particular intervention really belong. And so I understand a state saying, I used to cover it here, and if I had left it here, I would have been eligible for the 10%, and now I took it out of a category that is eligible for the 10%, and I might no longer be able to receive the enhanced FMAP. We acknowledge that could be the reality in a couple of different scenarios. This really is an exercise in determining not just temporarily for purposes of receiving an extra 10% on HCBS, but really in the long term, where does coverage for a particular intervention lie in the 1905A rubric? So we will provide the best technical answer that we can give you, but just wanted to acknowledge that this is on our radar screen as a result of some relatively recent and a little more long-term guidance about where coverage really goes in a particular benefit. And we understand that that might be generating some frustration, but we're happy to walk through all the technical reasons about why decisions were made about where coverage really belongs. Thanks.
Thanks, Melissa. Well, we'd like to now move to the phone line. So the operator, will you please provide instructions for the participants to register their questions, and then we'll see if we have any questions there.
Thank you. And at this time for your phone questions, please press star 1. Please unmute your phone and clearly record your name at the prompt. To withdraw your request, please press star 2. One moment, please, for questions to come through. Once again, at this time for phone questions, please press star 1. One moment, please. Our first question is from Renee. Your line is open.
Oh, hi. Thanks so much. And thanks for the information. So this is Renee Mala with California. So I do have a quick question. Do appreciate the guidance that was received in terms of the coverage for COVID-19 and for our Medicaid populations and for the uninsured coverage group. Will there be some similar guidance that's going to be coming out regarding restricted scope eligible that are covered in our Medicaid programs and how that coverage for treatment services may be covered by CMS?
This is Melissa, and I'll start and invite others to jump in. So if you look at the ARP, the specifics of the statute did not include the treatment mandates in the scope of services that limited benefit eligibles could receive, with the exception of individuals in what we used to refer to as the testing group. So those testing group individuals in states that elected that eligibility group do receive these treatment mandates. Other limited benefit individuals, like those receiving family planning only services or tuberculosis or breast and cervical cancer, their benefits were not amended by the ARP to include treatment of COVID-19 or treatment of a condition that could seriously complicate the treatment of COVID-19. So their benefits continue to not include those services.
Okay, thanks.
The next question is from Henry Littman. So your line is open.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Melissa, for your presentation. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on the SPA process that you referenced in your towards the end of your presentation. That's all I wanted to see if you could do a little bit more there. Thank you.
Sure. So we are looking to issue SPA templates for a couple of things. In recent weeks, we have issued guidance on COVID testing, now COVID treatment, and back some time ago through the vaccine toolkit, we issued guidance on coverage for vaccines as mandated through the ARP. All three of those different benefits lend themselves to SPA templates, and we are moving them all through our clearance in a pack. And so we will be issuing some templates as quickly as we can that really provide some streamlined guidance to really focus the state's attention on what information CMS needs in both a coverage and a reimbursement perspective for each of testing, treatment, and vaccines. Some of it will be done as checkboxes. Other components of it will be more text boxes. But we know that states are really interested in having that information on the street so they can tie up any loose ends in their state plan as it relates to those three ARP components. And so we will be issuing those as quickly as possible. In the meantime, if you have technical assistance questions, we're happy to try to answer those on a one-on-one call.
states are using the disaster relief state plan template in different ways, and so we're happy to look at what you already have in your either your underlying state plan or your disaster-related state plan, and then provide you with TA on how to stand up these testing, treatment, and vaccine mandates accordingly.
Thank you.
At this time, we are showing no further phone questions.
Thank you. Ashley, I do see one additional question in the chat.
Yep, it looks like we have a couple questions that just came in. So the first one is around Section 9817 of the ARP, and it says, regarding Section 9817 of the ARPA, regarding the Section 9817 state assurance to maintain services in the scope amount, duration, and scope in effect on April 1st, 2021. Does this mean that a state may not reduce HCBS services authorized for members during the ARP implementation period, or may states continue to apply medical necessity criteria for HCBS services authorized during the ARP implementation period? Specifically, if the medical necessity review determines that a member requires less services, can the state reduce services?
This is Melissa, and I'll start.
Go ahead.
I'll start, and then Ralph and Jen can weigh in. So the information in the State Medicaid Director Letter on 9817 was really at a program level or state level. That doesn't prohibit a state from making beneficiary level determinations based on a change in health status or what have you. So what a state can't do in order to continue qualifying for the enhanced FMAP is, for example, take down a service that was in existence as of April 1 or reduce that service. Let's say put a cap on the number of hours of a particular service or make it harder for a beneficiary to qualify for a 1915C waiver or other HCBS program. But at the beneficiary level, as beneficiaries' health statuses are changing and a beneficiary needs a different scope and maybe a lesser scope of services as time passes, that is totally fine to do. Individuals should not be receiving unnecessary services as part of the MOE requirements in 9817. It's really more a programmatic level decision on the state's part that is implicated in the MOE. But Ralph and Jen, what else would you add to that?
There is specific language on page 4 of the SMDL that says CMS understands that states may experience enrollment and utilization fluctuations unrelated to changes in state policies and procedures, especially during COVID-19 PHE. CMS will not apply penalties or noncompliance restrictions on the receipt of the increased FMAP if states experience reductions in HCBS enrollment, service utilization, or expenditures that are unrelated to changes in state policies or procedures. So if your policies and procedures call, for instance, an annual assessment of the individual's needs, and the plan of care is amended to meet the needs of the individual who demonstrates less need for service, then that would be considered a fluctuation that was not occurring because of a change in policy and procedure, but rather a fluctuation that occurred as part of the state's standing policy and procedure that was in place as of April 1st, 2021. Jen?
The only thing I'll add is just I would encourage any states that are concerned about potential MOE violations either to reach out to their spending plan reviewer or their HCBS lead, and, you know, we can provide state-specific technical assistance.
Okay. Then I let's see. It looks like we have another question around SCX and eligibility and enrollment verification, so we'll just flag that, again, our SNEs, we're not able to make today's call, so we'll take that one back and follow up on our next call. Then we have a question that says, will CMS be issuing guidance on the 12-month postpartum extension soon because their state is needing to consider systems changes?
Hey, Ashley, it's Amy Lutzke again, and I can enthusiastically say that, yes, we are working on guidance in this area. We know states are interested and eager, and we should be able to get some guidance out soon.
Thanks, Amy. And it looks like there are no other questions in the chat right now.
Thanks, Ashley. So we'll transition back to the phone lines. And operator, can you provide instructions one additional time on how to register questions? And then we'll see if we have any questions through the phone lines.
Thank you. And once again, for your phone questions, please press star one at this time and provide your name at the prompt. One moment, please. Thank you for standing by. We are showing no phone questions at this time.
Thank you. Ashley, I do see one additional question in the chat.
Sure. And it says, will CMS be issuing guidance on Medicare penalties for late enrollment for those who were on Medicaid and did not enroll because they were not aware they needed to? And I guess I'll just say I think that this is an unwinding-related question, so we'll probably need to take that back and follow up next week.
So I'm not seeing any additional questions in the chat. We don't have any additional questions through the phone line, so I think we'll give everyone a few minutes back today. But I'd like to close by saying thank you to Melissa, Julie, and Ruth for their presentations today. Looking forward, we will meet with you again on Tuesday, November the 9th, so we will provide the invitations and topics very soon. If you do have questions before the next call, feel free to reach out to us, your state lead, or you may bring your question to the next call. If you'd like to pre-submit a question for the open Q&A portion of our next call, you can email it to MedicaidCOVID19, all one word, at cms.hhs.gov by 1 p.m. Eastern time on the day of the call. We want to thank everyone for joining us today and hope everyone has a good afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you. That does conclude today's conference. We do appreciate you attending. You may disconnect at this time.